afternoon. I'm Serena Howe. I teach middle and high school at the St. Timothy School in Dallas, and I am getting my master's in literature at the University of Dallas. I got interested in Owen Barfield in college when I had a crush on a philosophy student who was interested in Owen Barfield, so I thought, well, I like you, maybe I like Owen Barfield. So I read Owen Barfield, and sure enough, I've been reading him off and on since then. I'm going to, there's a little bit of an outline on that handout I gave you. I'm going to try to stick with it pretty well. I'm going to start out with a biography, and then I'm going to go into sort of setting up the problem that Owen Barfield is dealing with, because he is very philosophical, okay? Unlike the other Inklings, he's not primarily a fiction writer, though he did actually start his career writing fiction and poetry. He's primarily some kind of a philosopher or a linguist. And so if we don't understand the problem that he's trying to work through in his work, we're not really going to understand the answer that he comes to. I'm going to define some key terms for you, and then we're going to launch into a summary of his thought. Most people who know anything about Owen Barfield know about him primarily because of his friendship with C.S. Lewis. Have any of you read him before now? Any people who have read Owen Barfield? What have you read? Which ones have you read? I'm just curious. Oh, you read all? Oh no, we have an expert in the room. I'm going to step down. I'm just curious. But most people who know about him through his relationship with C.S. Lewis. If you've read Surprised by Joy, you've read about Lewis meeting him in college, and he calls him his second friend. If you remember that, if your first friend is the person that you meet who is like you, you're person you meet that you have this experience of having a soulmate. Wow, there's somebody in the world who's like me, who's read the things that I like, who has the same feelings that I have about things. The second friend is the person who is like you, who's read all the things that you've read, is interested in the same things that you're interested in, and has the exact opposite opinions about everything, right? He's read all the wrong books and has come to all the wrong conclusions. And so you go to him and say, you're wrong here. And he says, no, but you're even more wrong over there. And that's the kind of relationship that Lewis and Barfield had. They loved each other very dearly their whole lives until Lewis's death, and were very dear to each other. And Lewis actually calls him the wisest and best of his unofficial teachers. I'm not really going to be going into their friendship in this class, but hopefully after talking about Owen Barfield, you'll be able to see where some of his ideas may have really influenced Lewis. My goal is to just offer you a taste of Owen Barfield's thought. He's a very cosmic thinker. He's a very broad thinker, very complex thinker, and it's beyond the scope of my knowledge or time to give you a full picture of his philosophy. So I'm going to be primarily talking about language and consciousness today. He deserves to be wrestled with, and my hope is that you will at least be intrigued enough that you'll go and read him after you leave this room. I'm hoping to talk for about a half an hour and then open it up for questions. And he can be difficult. And I would like you to keep track of questions that you would like to ask. I'm hoping to start a discussion at the end. Yesterday went way over and we didn't get a chance to do that. But hopefully I'll stand on time today. So Arthur Owen Barfield was born on the 9th of November in 1898 in North London. His father was a solicitor, and by all descriptions, his family was very content and comfortable. The home atmosphere seems to have been very intellectual and artistic, and they were particularly musical. And later on in his life, Owen Barfield said that even though he had spent most of his intellectual life thinking about poetry and language in particular, if he could only have one art in his personal life, it would be music. His mother was an early feminist and was very involved in the women's suffrage movement in England. Both of his parents were agnostics, not militant agnostics, but sort of gently skeptical late Victorians. They were all very moderate in all of their causes, so even though she was involved in the women's suffrage movement, very active, she never sort of went to some of the extremes that the movement went to, and was just very a very reasonable person, as was the whole family. They were very much like the reserved, kind of stiff upper lip late Victorians. If anything, the Barfields showed a strong distrust and even a distaste for the non-rational. including emotion. Barfield later wrote that the atmosphere in my family was predominantly critical and skeptical, not only in the matter of religion, but about, for instance, the kind of people one met. One was apt to suspect any kind of enthusiasm as being a bit humbugging and an affectation. In fact, it was a very common word in my family, that someone was affected. I was led to see myself, too, in those terms, and I suspected that anything in the nature of what seemed like a powerful emotional experience in terms of such things as poetry was self-deception. This attitude in the family also carried over to religion, as I said, and even though they didn't play tennis on Sundays, for instance, in respect for the Sabbath, they did not practice at all, and he grew up without the faith. At the age of 8, he started commuting to Highgate School, which is the same school that the poet William Taylor Coleridge went to about 150 years before Barfield. And Coleridge actually becomes a main subject of study for Barfield later in his life. And he's put in a classics track, so he primarily studies the classical languages. At that time, you would be put in one of a few different tracks. You could either do modern languages, classical languages, or they had more like a science track too, I believe. There may have been more than those three tracks. He won a classic scholarship to Wadham College in Oxford, but was quickly called to service in World War I, where he served in Belgium in some sort of communications, which left him lots of times to read copiously. In 1919, he returned from the war to attend college, where he met C.S. Lewis. As I've said, Lewis called Barfield his second friend. Barfield taught him to reject chronological snobbery. At the time, Lewis, even though it's somewhat unimaginable reading most of Lewis's work now, he was a complete, very thoroughgoing materialist at the time, I think is how Lewis described himself. So a materialist, like, the only stuff in the universe is this physical stuff in front of you. And he was very suspicious of the imagination, of non-rational ways of encountering the world. Barfield, interestingly enough, he reacted the opposite way to his upbringing. He was very appreciative of his family's emphasis on reason, but he saw that there was something missing. There was an emotive, the emotive quality of human life, the non-rational part of human life, he saw as being equal to reason. And so he tried in his own life and in his philosophy to find a way to synthesize the non-rational with the rational, the imagination with the rational, find a way that they work together to create the whole of human life. And so he and Lewis had what they called the Great War. Lewis called it the Great War, Surprised by Joy, which was in person and in letters. And they were arguing specifically about imagination and the role of the imagination. And the imagination becomes a central topic for both of their work later on in life. Now, Lewis at the time, his position was that the only way to know the truth, the only way to know the world outside of one is through reason and scientific study, which is kind of unimaginable reading Lewis's later stuff. But it was through this great war with Owen Barfield, who believed that imagination is not only like a legitimate way of understanding the world, but is crucial. And we all are knowing the world through imagination all of the time, only we don't even know it. Okay, so if you're claiming that you're completely rational, you're really just lying to yourself. That's Barfield's case. And he's the one who actually converts C.S. Lewis towards, away from materialism and towards some kind of conception of the divine and of the transcendent. Barfield's first book was a fairy tale called The Silver Trumpet, which both Lewis and Tolkien loved. Lewis actually sent it to Tolkien, who read it to his children, and his children loved it so much that Tolkien said he was a little bit hurt that they liked Barfield's book better than his stories. And Tolkien's children said, "Oh, please don't give the book back to Mr. Lewis." So it was a big hit. Then he published Poetic Diction in 1928, so he would have been about 29 when he published that. Poetic Diction is right here, subtitle Study of Meaning. It is thinking about language. So what's the nature of language? What's the nature of consciousness? Where does language come from? Where does poetry come from? Why is poetry important? It is a revision of the bachelor's thesis that he wrote at Oxford, which is incredibly impressive. My bachelor's thesis is nothing of this sort of intellectual heft. Now, instead of entering academia, as did Tolkien and Lewis, his father died and he had to become a solicitor in his father's place, right? So the solicitor is a lawyer. And he took over the family business and was pretty torn about this. He seemed to have had a really good family life. But he was not always particularly happy with having to be a lawyer. His works weren't quite as widely received in academic circles. Now, Lewis had the highest regard for Barfield's thought, and so he actually promoted poetic diction, the ideas in poetic diction in his classes. And years later, after Lewis's death, one of Lewis's pupils told Barfield that, quote, "At that time, there were two schools of thought in Oxford, one of which held that there really was a man called Owen Barfield who had really written a book called Poetic Diction, and others who held that it was simply a name invented by Lewis when he wanted to put forward some idea that he didn't want to take full responsibility of." So that gives you an idea of how close to Lewis's own thought Barfield was, how much of a teacher Barfield was to Lewis in his lectures that he gave. Now, Lewis actually became a Christian before Barfield, even though that Barfield sort of started the process. Barfield does everything slowly. He moves slowly and organically. And so he wasn't baptized until middle life. Before then, he was a disciple of, and remained till the end of his life, of a man called Rudolf Steiner in anthroposophy. Has anyone ever heard of anthroposophy? It is a philosophical system that sort of, this is going to be a generalization, but Rudolf Steiner died in 1925, so he was writing in like the late 18th century, early 19th century. Late 19th century, early 20th century. He's reacting against materialism and the deification of the scientific method, right? The scientific method says we're going to study the world as if we're apart from the world, right? It's what we call a subject-object divide. I'm the subject, you're the object. I'm going to study you as if you're different from me. Now, that's great as a methodology, as a way of doing a subject, but once you apply that to all of life, then we have problems, once we say that that's the only way that you can approach the world. And that's what Steiner was reacting against, and even just claiming that this is the only way we can do science. So Steiner sort of approaches philosophy and science from the perspective of what would this all look like if we assume that consciousness and imagination were actually part of the system. What would it look like if we studied the natural world as if we're part of the natural world? Okay, and he has some really interesting ideas of participation in the world, of farming. Has anyone heard of biodynamic farming? It's this whole idea that like the planets are influencing the crops and time is influencing the crops. In a lot of ways, it's a return to an older view of the cosmos, that everything is interconnected and everything, you know, even, you know, the rising of Venus affects when I should harvest my carrots. It sounds silly, but earlier peoples actually did think about the world in this way. And Steiner takes it seriously, and Barfield takes it seriously. Now, there's some other problematic aspects of Steiner's thought that you should be aware of, since Barfield was a disciple of Steiner's in a lot of ways. And we're still not sure, not a lot of work has been done on Barfield's life, so we're not sure exactly to what extent Steiner, like the weirder aspects of Steiner's philosophy influenced him. So reincarnation is a big part of Steiner's thought. And there is kind of this esotericism there that, proto-New Agey would be a good way. And even though Barfield was a member of the Church of England, he was actually buried under Rudolf Steiner's Christian denomination called the Christian Community. So there's some ambiguity there in his own life. But we can say that the incarnation and the work of God, the participatory work of God in nature, is a huge part of Barfield's thought too. So there are two poles that we're still kind of working through. One more remark about his conversion. As he was slowly exposed to the theology of the incarnation, Barfield found his perception of Jesus slowly expanding. Poetry and the beauty of the oratorios and other art, the Messiah, for instance, also contributed to Barfield's increasing consciousness until at last he found himself a convinced Christian. And later on in his life, he says that the incarnation and the life and death of Christ was at the center of all of his thought and of the evolutionary process. And I, you're going to be like, what? The evolutionary process? That's strange. But file that away and we'll go back to it. What does Barfield mean by evolution? Because it's going to be a key term. So he died December 14th, 1997, at the age of 99. And like I said, he was buried under the Christian community funereal rites. So then the biographical project of his whole life is, how do we unify imagination with intellect? So I'm going to be primarily talking about two books today, or drawing from two books, and that's Poetic Diction, which I've already talked about, and Saving the Appearances, subtitled A Study in Idolatry. I'm going to be talking about idolatry. What does Barfield mean by idolatry in this book? And they're both really great representatives of Barfield's thought. So as I warned you earlier, this may seem a little bit dry and abstract. He's a philosopher. Barfield, towards the end of his life, said that all of his work was thinking about thinking. He once said that there were five different Lewises, but he was always the same old Barfield talking about the same things. And thinking about language and thinking about thinking can give you a headache pretty quickly. And I hope to convince you that the problem of language and of consciousness is not only terrifically exciting, because I think it is, but also very pressing for today's world. Now, as I like to remind my students, and as Douglas Adams illustrated in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, if you've ever read that, answers don't mean anything to you if you don't have a question. So what's the question here? I'm not going to convince you that Barfield has any answers for living in the postmodern age, which is something I want to convince you of, unless you know what we're wrestling with. So why should we care about any of this? Few of us here are probably living in an academic context where people are constantly arguing about language. If you're at all aware of the current debates, particularly in the humanities, the question of language and does language actually mean anything? Is language just a matter of power struggles? Is that what language is fundamentally? Does language actually access the world, or is it something we just create? These are very important academic questions of our time. And most of us are not in that world. But we do live in a world that's created by those questions, by that academic conversation that's going on. And we need to understand that conversation because we're downstream and everything's washing down and it looks a little bit different down here. But we need to understand the headwaters, and Barfield's a good way of understanding the headwaters. So that's one reason why we need to understand Barfield, even though he's a little complex sometimes. Secondly, and this maybe a little bit controversial, but a lot of what I personally hear passing for conservative Christian and cultural apologetics is definitely working within what I will call a modern framework, a philosophically modern way of looking at the world, which is not a Christian way of looking at the world. And it's a way of looking at the world that refuses to understand the legitimate questions that postmodernity, both as an intellectual phenomenon and as a cultural phenomenon, are raising. So Barfield gives us a way of asking some of the same questions as are being asked today, but hopefully tackle them in a more fruitful way than maybe they're being tackled today. So I'm going to start with a little bit of a thought experiment and then an illustration on the board, and I'm already talking longer than I wanted to, but everyone close your eyes. The goal of this exercise is to weird you out. I want you to feel a little bit dislocated when you open your eyes again. I want you to start to feel that maybe the world isn't what we take for granted. I want you to imagine, with your eyes closed, that you have no memory at all. And not only do you have no memory, you also have no language, and you can't understand language. Okay, open your eyes. What would the world be like? Now, it's almost impossible to imagine, right? You can't help but understand the words that I'm saying. You can't help but, when you look at the letters, or when I look at them because I'm looking at them, I can't help but recognize those letters. I can't help but recognize the color. And when I recognize them, there's some kind of a cognitive word in your mind, right? We're constantly calling, even mentally, words into our minds. And so language and memory are really closely connected. And that's what Barfield wants to point out here. Who of you can remember before you were 2 years old? Can anyone remember before they were two? A little bit? I can remember maybe a little bit. I don't know. But what about 2.5? Who can remember when they were about 2.5? 3? Ah, we have people with late memories here. Okay. Language, memory in children is very much linked to when they master language. You can't have memories, as far as we know, before you have language to articulate them. And this is part of what Barfield wants to get at, that language and memory and consciousness are related. I can only see the color here, this color orange, because I am the kind of creature that I receive wavelengths and my brain interprets the color as orange, right? But that experience is actually in my mind, right? There's no like orangeness here in the paper. They're just white wavelengths bouncing off. Even the shape of this room, we take it for granted. But if you had no memory, how would you experience this room? Can you even imagine experiencing the world as a random group of objects, not being able to recognize that these two chairs were the same? Because without memory, you can't do that. So Barfield's point is that we assemble the world through imagination. And imagination for Barfield is partially what a romantic idea of imagination, that through imagination, this is the way we use it today, you know, we create new things that haven't existed before. But imagination for Barfield is also, in the old meaning, the medieval meaning, I work in medieval studies primarily, medieval meaning of imagination is the faculty of receiving images in and then making sense of them. Because for the medievals, they're very aware of that the imagination is how you take these images and go, and your imagination goes, oh, those are the same things. There's nothing out in the world that will tell you that those chairs are the same. There's nothing out in the world that's going to tell you that that color blue and that color blue are both blue. This is a faculty of the imagination that makes those kinds of connections. So without imagination, and without imagination that's been shaped by your specific culture, you would not experience the world the way that you do. Now, Barfield, even though he talks about language, also talks about science a lot. And he's very aware of the developments in quantum mechanics, particularly, that are going on during his lifetime, even 20 years before his lifetime, which are kind of blowing up the whole scientific paradigm, right? I just told you that in scientific method, you assume that you're outside of the system, right? You try to distance yourself as much as you can from the system that you're studying. Well, here's a little experiment in quantum physics, which demonstrates that may not be the case, and the world is a lot weirder than what we think it is. Okay? Has anyone ever heard of the double slit? It's also called Young's experiment, the double slit experiment. Okay. So here we have a light source and a wall with two slits in it. And here we have some kind of a photographic paper. Okay, and we're shining light through here. Now, this is a very special flashlight in that we can fire one photon at a time. So we're firing one photon at a time at this wall. Now, a photon is not just a particle, right? What else is it? It behaves as both a particle and a wave. So if it's behaving as a particle, what pattern would you expect to see over here? If I was shooting ping pong balls through these two slots, what kind of a pattern would arise over here? You'd expect to see a bar, right? If I shot enough ping pong balls, right? I would expect to see a bar on this side and a bar on this side, and then maybe some kind of a gradient going out because some of the ping pong balls would splash away. But it would be primarily these two balls. That's actually not what we see because it's behaving as a wave. What we see is the wave of light goes out like this, like ocean waves, and then it goes through these two slits, and the waves are redistributed, and they go out like this from each of the slits. Now, if you've ever seen waves at the beach or at a pond, you'll notice what we call lines of interference, right? Where two waves meet, they cancel out. And so what we see, instead of just those two bars, is we actually see stripes of light and dark, because where these waves interact at the troughs, they cancel each other out, we get dark, and at the crests, they intensify. So we get like bars of light and dark. It's acting as a wave. But if we observe this, we say, well, what's going on? Because it's also somehow it's also a particle. So if you could observe, which you can't really in this way exactly, but if you could observe, they've done this, to try to figure out the position of that photon, all of a sudden the act of observation itself determines where that photon is, because at a quantum level, particles exist at all possible places at once. Which is mind-blowing, right? Like, how could that possibly be the case? But it is. The photon, as this bar of light, they were at all possible places at once. Now, this is also all metaphor. And that's another thing Barfield's getting at. The way I'm even just talking about this, this is a metaphor. And that's what physics is. It's metaphors for the way the world is. We're not offering up models that totally explain everything that's going on, but we're offering up metaphors to try to understand, well, what is this like? And so the act of observation here then, actually observing your consciousness somehow, made that photon not just exist at every possible point, but at one point. Okay, so this is an experiment which demonstrates the fact that consciousness actually interacts with the material world on a quantum level. Now, like you're saying, New Age. New Age philosophy takes this and goes all kinds of weird places with it. Barfield doesn't do that. What he wants to convince you of is that the world is something fundamentally different than what you commonly think it is as you go through life. You take the world for granted. Oh, you know, it just is just what it is. What Barfield wants to convince you of is that you're actually always participating in the world and changing it like a person, right? When, I can't know you without having a relationship with you. I guess I could just like follow you around creepily and study you, you know. But that would be something very different than if I had a relationship with you and we knew each other. But we can't know each other then without changing each other, right? Your life is something different because you know me now. My life is something different because I know you. Now, that doesn't mean that everything's meaningless, right? And we're all just like subjectively creating our own meaning all the time, because, you know, if I meet you and I think that you're a saint and your friend over here thinks that you are like a terrible human being, both of those can't be true about you, right? And, you know, me and another friend sat down and dissected you verbally for 3 hours, we would come to like a pretty, probably a pretty good model of who you were. Would that model completely explain everything about you? No. It wouldn't, right? But does that bother us when we're talking about human relationships? No, because we know that, right? We know that none of our models of another person, you know, I know that your Myers-Briggs test is never going to quantify everything about you. So when we look at the world, why do we assume that because we get certain scientific material results, that that's contradictory with any other possible levels of meaning that are going on at the same time? It's like, I can quantify you with a Myers-Briggs test. There's also lots of other ways of interacting with you at the same time. All right. So I've already mentioned the term evolution. I want to go over that term really quickly. Barfield, the idea of evolution is really central to Barfield's thought. The ideas of things going from an origin and developing onward. Okay, but he's not a materialist. He doesn't necessarily believe in like a Darwinian model of evolution. He actually kind of goes beyond that. So for Barfield, really quickly, because he believes that consciousness helps create the world, just like God creates the world through words, the human person, and more specifically the human community, also like co-participates in that creation through language, through memory, through meaning. The human community creates meaning, it participates in the divine meaning. So we start out, for Barfield, we start out with what he calls original participation. And here we have the first man. And then for Barfield, it goes onwards. Now, one way that Barfield's idea of evolution is different than Darwinian evolution is that it's what we would call teleological, meaning that it has an end, right? Darwinian evolution, like suggesting that evolution has a destination to a biologist is like anathema, right? But for Barfield, the idea of a development and a human evolution of consciousness, is what he says, is built into the system. It's a way God made human beings to be. That God created human beings as this thing here and intended them to grow and to become something different. So that the way that we experience consciousness today, like here's you, The way you experience the world and yourself as a conscious being is fundamentally different than the way this first person experienced consciousness. And he calls the way this first person experienced consciousness as, he calls it original participation. So today, you experience yourself as being fundamentally different than the world. Right? You experience yourself as being basically alone. No one can ever access your inner thoughts. You are an individual. And the choices that you make are your own choices, right? They're not the choices of the community. And insofar as you interact with the community, you think of yourself as doing it on your own volition, right? But you're basically an individual. And you experience the world as other than you. But original participation, such as this original person experienced, he actually experienced the world as somehow in communion with himself. Okay? And this is kind of a hard concept to grasp because, according to Barfield, we've almost completely lost. Like, what would that be like to participate in the world? And the best example that I've come up with, and Barfield also suggested, is the experience of being in love. This is maybe one of the only places that we all experience participation, because when you fall in love with somebody, all of a sudden the world is aglow with this meaning, right? And that meaning that you experience is almost identical with the other person, right? In this like visceral way. You're not thinking about it at all. It's not like a rational construct that you have. It's this visceral experience of like meaning and pleasure and significance that somehow like incarnate in this other person, but like also in like transcendent, right? People describe it as like this transcendent feeling of having some sort of communication with like something beyond, right? Something like almost a connection with the eternal. If you read, you know, some people are more prone to these, you know, these things than others, I guess. But if you can imagine participating in everything in the world in a similar way, that's kind of what Barfield is talking about here. That everything, you experience it as meaning something in the way that you experience meaning that person that you love as meaning something, not in a rational way. This is not something that you're doing with your brain. This is something you're experiencing imaginatively. Now, this is very much in conflict with the way that anthropologists thought that language developed in Barfield's day, and I haven't kept up on this whole discussion today, but what does language have to do with this? And that's what I want to illustrate for you now. Well, say we have a word like the Greek word pneuma. Pneuma pneumatos. It means spirit. It means breath. I believe it can also mean wind. Is that right? Spirit, breath, wind. For us, these are all very different meanings, right? And it's almost unimaginable to you to think of those things as being the same, right? I don't experience my breath as being the same thing as the wind. I don't experience my spirit having anything to do with the wind, really. And so when anthropologists in Barfield's time looked back down through the dawn of history and asked the question, where does language come from? They saw that this original person, they believe that this original person was exactly, like, basically the same kind of being as you and me, okay? And so he saw an apple, say, in the springtime. Apples don't grow in the springtime. I'm clearly a product of the modern age and completely disconnected from the natural. Let's say a flower, because that grows in the spring. Okay. He sees a flower, and he names that flower a flower. Okay? It's a name. It's a label for the thing that he sees. And then he has kids. And he tells the kids about flowers, and he makes up stories for his kids. And so now the flower is associated with, well, let's say this imaginary person, Proserpina, who is abducted by the god of the underworld, and her mother, Demeter, warns. And so we have winter for 6 months, and then spring comes back when Persephone is back in the world, or Proserpina, comes back in the world. And so this flower then maybe gets associated with Proserpina, and maybe we say flower instead of Proserpina, but this is only within this imaginary world of stories. But then as time goes on, according to these anthropologists, people forget that the stories were just stories that they made up, and that's where we get mythology. They start believing the stories that they'd made up. The problem with this, according to Barfield, is that we assume that at some point in the past, people didn't think metaphorically. Okay? So as we go farther and farther back, like with the word pneuma, today, spirit, breath, wind are three very different things. As we go back, they become metaphorically connected. And they get more and more metaphorical. Language gets more and more metaphorical as we go back in the past. I did some work in Old English when I was in college. And trying to look up Old English words to do translations was mind-boggling because the same word would have like six different meanings. Okay? This is what happens in languages. You go farther back, things get more complicated, more analogical. Now, what the anthropologists assume is that at some point, things weren't analogical at all. Things weren't metaphorical at all. But Barfield says you can't make that jump. We have no evidence for that jump. If as we look back, things got more metaphorical, all we can assume is that they started out metaphorical. We can't assume this flower was a name that was given. So going back to original participation, for Barfield, that original person experienced in a visceral way that we can't understand except maybe when we think about love, experienced spirit, breath, and wind as one thing. Okay? That the word pneuma, that we can only translate as spirit, breath, wind, actually had its own discrete meaning to these original people that we can't comprehend today. But that somehow all these ideas were through metaphor, bound up together. And that's where we get poetry. Because poetry for Barfield, it's not just meter and rhythm and short lines and strange words. Poetry, poetic speech, is metaphor. And through metaphor, that's how we see that things are like each other. And that exercise I wanted you to do at the very beginning, I wanted you to recognize that without memory and without language, you would not recognize that things are alike. You take that for granted, that you just, things are alike. We all take it for granted. But how do you know that the beige of these chairs is like the beige on that wall? Because it's not the same color. It's just not the same color. Well, why do you associate them as being like? Barfield says that this happens through meaning, different meanings occur through metaphor. So originally we had this idea of pneuma. And then reason, we have imagination, which creates metaphor, and sees in ways that reason doesn't understand, connections between things in the world. And then reason then kind of steps back and says, well, how are they really different? And through that act of reason on what's been imagined, then we get, out of this one original meaning, we get three different meanings. And it goes on, right? We have more poets writing, more people using language. And as people use language and then think about using language, then the meanings get more and more diverse until today. We have all of these, what Barfield would call dead metaphors. We use all the time. Can anyone think of a dead metaphor? We're speaking metaphors all the time, but we don't even recognize it. For example, if I say that she flew to the other side of the room. Now, your mental image is not of her growing wings and flying, right? But if you take me literally there, what I'm saying, I'm using a metaphor. It's like, the way she moved was like flying, but we don't think of that. So we have all these dead metaphors that we use that don't mean anything to us anymore, in the same way that they used to. And the job of poets is then to resuscitate these original meanings that we've lost and to create new meanings through this interaction of imagination and reason. And I am already running out of time. I just want to talk a little bit more about his perception of science just really quickly, and particularly the battle he sees, not the battle, but the distinction between people who see the world just scientifically in his own time and those who see the world through philosophy. And it's a very funny, he's a very funny author. And so this may illustrate some of that humor too. He says, once upon a time, there was a very large motor car called the universe. And although there was nobody who wasn't on board, nobody knew how it worked or how to work it. And in the course of time, two very different problems occupied the attention of two very different groups of passengers. The first group became interested in invisible things, like internal combustion. But the second group said that the thing to do was to push levers and find out by trial and error. So on the first hand, you have the philosophers and the theologians, right, who are trying to figure out, well, how does this really work? On the second hand, you have the scientists who are pushing and pulling things to figure out how it works. The words internal combustion, they said, were obviously meaningless because nobody had ever pushed or pulled either of these things. For a time, both groups agreed that the knowledge of how it worked and the knowledge of how to work it were closely connected. So at one time, farther back in the Middle Ages, say, both ways of knowing the world through reason, through science, and through philosophy, people agreed that they were compatible. But then the second group began to maintain that the first kind of knowledge was an illusion based on a misunderstanding of language. Pushing and pulling and seeing what happens, they said, are not means to knowledge, but they actually are knowledge. It was an odd sort of car, because after the second group had, with conspicuous and gratifying success, tried pushing and pulling all of the big levers and began on some of the little tiny ones, the car was so constructed that nearly all of these, whatever the other effect they had, acted as accelerators. Meanwhile, the first group held their breath and began to think that their kind of knowledge might perhaps come in useful after the smash. And that's where Barfield sees that his culture is in, that a misunderstanding of the nature of knowledge has accelerated this process of human consciousness, the evolution of human consciousness, and has diverted it. Because for Barfield, the center of history and the center of human evolution is Jesus Christ. And that in Jesus Christ we see that God enters his creation and reveals what man is finally supposed to be. Finally supposed to become. And then in the eschaton, the fullness of that creation will finally be revealed. And so Barfield sees that in his own time, science has derailed, not derailed it, because you can't derail the work of God, but has accelerated this process of human evolution in a way that prioritizes reason more than anything. So just to finish up really quickly, why does Barfield matter? Barfield matters, I'm just going to touch on something really briefly and then you can ask questions. Barfield matters for one thing because he reminds us of what we've forgotten. We take the world for granted, the way we experience the world for granted, in a way that Barfield will call idolatry. Idolatry for Barfield is assuming that the way that you see the world is the total explanation for the world. Okay. For him, the Copernican revolution, for example, is a revolution, not because Copernicus says the earth goes around the sun, people have known that for a long time, but because for the first time, instead of just offering this as a model, okay, a way of understanding the world, for the first time, people start thinking that is the only way to view the world. Okay? Medievals had no problem thinking of the celestial bodies as both participation in the glory of God, showing forth the glory of God, the music of the spheres, and as a ball of gas. Except for them, the way they conceived it, the more important thing was of course this chair is a chair. That's not the most important thing about that chair. A cross, well, of course it's made out of gold, but the important thing about the cross is not what it's made of, it's what it means, right? That's how they see the whole universe. So, well, of course it's made out of these things. Why are you getting derailed on what it's made out of? The important thing is what it means. And so today we have a lot of analogies, we have a lot of metaphors left over that have died, and we need to revive them. We can't go back, and Barfield would say it's not good to go back, right? Just like a human person, you want to grow up and you don't want to go back to being three. We don't want to go back to this. We don't want to go back to what he calls original participation. We want to move forward. But sometimes in order to move forward, you have to remember what we've lost. And so participation is a word I've said a lot. And one area in all of our lives that we need to regain, what is participation, is the Eucharist, right? We talk about participation in the Eucharist all the time, and we talk about it so much, I don't know about you, but I don't think it has too much meaning for me. I don't really know what it's like to participate. And Barfield would say that's a particularly modern predicament to be in, not knowing how to participate in the world. Not, that doesn't even mean anything to you. It's not even something you realize that you've lost because you experience yourself as being an individual. Whereas even, you know, even the Middle Ages, if you read them, they think of themselves as being part of the community in a way that you can't conceive of thinking yourself being part of the community, as being not primarily an individual. So our liturgy is full of these symbols and these ways of talking about the world that should be hearkening us back to a fuller view of the human person and of the human life. And in order to recapture that and then to move forward, I think Barfield gives us some very helpful theoretical frameworks, intellectual frameworks, thinking about, well, what does it mean to be a human being? What is the role of the human person in the world? What is our responsibility? Because consciousness for Barfield makes you responsible. Okay. Once you become conscious, you're now responsible for that knowledge. So that's about all I had to say about Barfield. Are there any questions in the last few minutes? Unfortunately, I went over. Yes? On Revelation? Yeah. So he's... Oh, yeah. Thank you. So the question is, what is Barfield's view of Revelation, particularly of God's revelation in the world? That's a really good question. I, as far as I read of Barfield, which is not as extensively as I would like, I haven't seen him deal with that specifically. He definitely does talk about the Jews and of the Jews being called out from the other nations by God. And so he definitely does believe that, like, God is guiding human evolution, evolution of consciousness, and particularly, you know, through this particular race of the Jews, calling them out of this original participation, he would say, of this way of viewing the world as immediate. Because if you view the world this way, there's a temptation towards animism. That's a simplification. Barfield wouldn't quite say that. But Barfield says that God has a pedagogical purpose in requiring the Jews to see the world not as an emanation of God, but as like the presence of God as being inner, through the name, right, through I am. And so calling people to participate in God in a way and in a deeper way than what's available here, in a way that will only be brought to fruition later on through the person of Christ. So because he has a very anthropological view of Christ, for example, he doesn't see the crucifixion as being necessary. For him, if the Jews had actually been living the way they were supposed to have been living, the kingdom of God could have come to earth in a different way, that Christ would have reigned then. Which is not to say that he sees the crucifixion as like bad or anything, just that it could have happened another way. But I'm not sure other forms of revelation what he would say. Maybe, yeah. He definitely has some. He has some other ideas, and it's sometimes it's hard to tease out all the. For me, it's a little hard to tease out all the theological ramifications. I think Saving the Appearances is a really interesting book. I think it should be about four times as long to really figure out what all he's saying. Yeah.
The young man is doing all these things to create like razor self-awareness.
Yeah. Yeah. So the question is, was Lewis playing with the idea of original participation in Paralandra? I can't quite remember. It's been like 6 years since I read Paralandra. Is Lewis making fun of that whole idea there, or is he being...
Not at all. He's the young man is trying to raise the self-awareness.
Right.
Her to be able to step outside herself,
oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I'm not sure. And this is an area. Okay. So another thing about Rudolf Steiner, because I told you that Barfield was involved in anthroposophy. Steiner sees the fall as being necessary and good. Okay. That people aren't supposed to stay in this state of original participation. So these Luciferian beings had to like come down and elevate man. I don't think Barfield would buy that. Okay. Like Barfield's not that unorthodox. But I think, the whole idea of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, I know the Eastern mystics, for example, I can't remember who it is specifically, but they have this idea that that God right? And Christians generally have had this idea that Adam and Eve were intended to grow, right? Grow in the image of God. And that maybe at some future point, they would have been allowed to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, right? It wasn't that the tree was evil, it was that they took something disobediently in a way that wasn't supposed to have been taken. Okay, and I think that that could be an image of what Lewis is doing there in Paralandra. That it's not like the kind of consciousness, because they do actually end up achieving that kind of consciousness at the end of the book, right? But they're given that as God. They don't take it, they're given it. So I do think that, that is probably a manifestation of maybe some of Barfield's thought in Lewis, that we are supposed to be developing towards this other thing. I mean, in the abolition of man, Lewis does pick up this idea of human evolution. He calls it, what does he call it? He says that all things are coming to a point, I think is what he says, that things are becoming more different. And so I think that may be an example of one place where Lewis is playing with that, but also saying, we need to be obedient. We need to take these things as God intends for us to take them. One distinction that Lewis made between himself and Barfield is he said that for Barfield, the purpose of human life is to become free. Whereas for Lewis, the purpose of human life is to serve God. Okay, so these are different attitudes that I think do result in some differences of theology there. And Lewis is definitely emphasizing there not just consciousness, but obedience, the importance of obedience. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, magic. I know I didn't really get there. Well, okay, so I don't really have time for this. But I put the magic in there because I wanted you guys to come. And I wanted to just... No. But this whole idea that if you experience the world in the way that I've been trying to articulate to you, like experience meaning directly, and words is powerful in the world, and consciousness is powerful in the world. Barfield like kind of opens up the space for magic in the sense of human cognition interacting with the world and changing it. And Barfield also does like believe in spirits, right? That spirits that are sort of stand parallel to humanity. But I think you might talk about that in What Coleridge Thinks. I have to look it up. But yeah, it's not. I kind of just threw it in as a bonus. I hope to get into it, but I didn't have time. Yes.
You mentioned the Greek word for spirit. Mm-hmm. I thought about the Acts chapter 2.
Pardon?
Acts chapter 2. The sound of the rushing wind came, and it was the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was a comment connecting the idea of the unity of the word pneuma to Acts chapter 2. I don't know if I have too much to comment on that. But yeah, there's an idea of unity there. And certainly Barfield would say that, I think before the scientific revolution, he would say that people experience the world in a fundamentally different way than you do, and in a greater sense of participation. Yeah. Barfield takes very, very seriously that idea of the breath and of the word and of human participation in the breath and the word of God. All right. Well, I think we're out of time. We need to head back to the plenary session. Thank you so much.